Well, thank you for being here at my 19th book talk since I started June 25th from Portland on my hand cycle. I did arrive on the across the Golden Gate Bridge on Saturday after 1,700 miles. I don't know if Joel's in the room, but Joel was my, back there in the back corner, he was my cycling companion who hauled our bike trailer with all our gear, sleeping bags, tent, a little bit of food, extra clothes. I'm actually feeling a little tired today. Looking forward to a few days off. But it's been a pretty amazing journey. I decided to do the book tour, at least the Pacific Northwest part, by hand cycle, because I'm actually part of a transition town initiative in Portland in which we're talking about energy descent and changing our lives so we're using less carbon. And I felt that I had to demonstrate my commitment to that by traveling on this book tour without burning fossil fuels. And so I average about 10 miles an hour and about 45 miles a day. And so my friends in Portland who are part of the Transition Town movement thought I was joking when I said I was going to hand cycle to San Francisco. So now I can tell them I actually did it. I arrived, and maybe they'll start cycling too. Who knows? So thank you, Dan, for that introduction and for all you being here. This book took about 8 years to write after many years of procrastinating. And then because things keep happening, so you have to keep updating it. It was rejected by 33 publishers. And finally, PM Press from Oakland over here by the table. I agreed to publish a 500-page book, which was a little bigger than the normal market will allow for a reasonable price. And the book was written really primarily to answer a question that has been with me ever since I left Vietnam, which was in August of 1969. The question is this. It was a question I was asking me, not the culture, not anybody else but me. How was it so easy for the little good kid from a little farming community in Western New York, who was a good basketball player, a good baseball player, who was a good Boy Scout, who was active in Baptist Youth Fellowship, who was Honor Society and Student Council in a small school, how was it so easy to follow an order of another man to go halfway, 9,000 miles from my hometown to another country to participate in destroying their community and their villages? It's pretty absurd, really. It's beyond comprehension. It became something beyond comprehension to me, and I kind of kept putting it aside, because I wasn't sure I wanted to answer the question. But I felt it went to the essence of the human condition. And so to do this memoir, I had to read a lot of evolutionary biology, quantum physics, archaeology, anthropology, lots of history. I wanted to get a sense of the big picture of the human evolution, especially the emotional development, the psychic development, and consciousness. I really wanted to know how it was so easy to be dumbed down, be so successfully adaptive to the mores of my society, which made me, in my mind, very dehumanized. It took going to Vietnam for me to recognize how dehumanized I had become. Now, I was older when I was in Vietnam. I turned 28 in Vietnam, and I was not a lifer. I got drafted at 25 out of graduate school. This is before the lottery. Now, I was raised in a very right-wing family, both in terms of politics and religion. But for me, when I was young, sports was everything. Ideology wasn't very important to me. And by the mid-60s, I was very much a continued believer in killing the commies, protecting freedom and democracy from all those evil people. But I wanted to stay in graduate school. And so in those days, that was called a chicken hawk. You were a hawk on the war, but you were a chicken. You didn't want to fight in the war. But I got stuck. I got drafted. I had no reason to get out of it because I didn't have any politics or philosophy that would suggest I should try to escape. And so instead of going in the Army after I was drafted, I enlisted in the Air Force for 4 years and became an officer, thinking that was the easy way out. I would make more money. And when I was commissioned, on the day I was commissioned, I bought a Corvette. It was the first time in my life I actually had now spending money. So a Corvette was my symbol of success. There's a picture of it in the book, actually. It's contrasted with the car that I bought when I came back from Vietnam, which was a Volkswagen Beetle with flower decals on it. I had traded in my Corvette on a Volkswagen Beetle. It did represent, actually, a change. My third year in the Air Force, I was, after being a plush assignment in Washington, D.C., in Headquarters Air Force, I was ordered to become what I would call a low-level commander of an Air Force Ranger unit to be trained at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to go to Vietnam with 40 men and protect air bases from attacks. I didn't want the assignment, but, you know, I was in the military and you follow orders. And I'd always been very loyal and obedient. So on March 8th, we landed in the Mekong Delta. Got off the plane. Actually, the base was under an attack. It was almost midnight. And so there I was in a bunker hearing explosions, thinking, wow, I don't know. I really didn't want to be here. Did not want to be in this situation. So my men became the combat security unit that was on the perimeter of the base. And so we had the heavy machine guns, the starlight scopes, the anti-personnel radar, the outgoing mortar units. And, you know, we were always subject to attacks fairly regularly. But I was given an extra duty by the Vietnamese base commander, which was to assess the success or failure of airstrikes on targets. The reason that he gave to me, saying that he was wondering whether I would be willing to do this, it was all during the daytime, was that he had heard that the new South Vietnamese pilots that had just been trained in Louisiana that had arrived, and the new plane, the new A-37 fighter bombers that the U.S. had just given to the South Vietnamese, and this was Vietnamization after Nixon was elected, spring of 69, and there was a lot of pressure to upgrade the number of body counts that could be attributed to success of the war. And the rumor was that some of these pilots were, quote-unquote, VC, were going to sabotage their targets. So he wanted a U.S. officer to go and just do some spot checking with one of his officers who would show me where to go with my Jeep. I didn't think much about it. I was pretty naive. It was not a dangerous mission at all because it was daytime. And the very first village we went to was around April 12th or 13th, 1969, in Vinh Long province in the Delta. And it was not that far from Binh Tui, maybe 4 miles as the crow flies. Binh Tui was the base I was at. And as we got out of the Jeep, the smoke was coming up behind the tall elephant grass, and I heard a roar to my right, which was this water buffalo with a third of its skull gone and a big gash in its belly, just screaming in pain. And I was already in shock just from that. And then I turned to my left, and there were all these bodies in the smoke, and all the buildings were burning or already had burned. And I started walking to my left, and I couldn't walk any further because there was bodies there. I just couldn't walk anymore. And by this time, I was even more shocked, and I think I was actually maybe crying, or I was throwing up bile juice or something. I was actually quite physiologically affected by the scene. I got to the point where I couldn't walk any further, and I looked down and I saw this woman with three children, clutching three children. They were all dead, as were most of the people on the ground. Some were moaning, so they were still alive. I could smell the napalm in the air, the burning flesh, and the chemical residue from the weapons. And I had this experience of looking at that woman's eyes, because she was lying on her back looking up, I thought, at me, realizing that the napalm had burned her eyelids and her facial skin, but her eyes were looking, I experienced it as her eyes were looking at my eyes were looking at her eyes. At that moment, I got it. She and I are the same. It was kind of an overwhelming experience and epiphany, realizing that she and I were part of the same family. I was 9,000 miles from my hometown in upstate New York. She was in her village. And it struck me how absurd this was, how criminal, how diabolical. But it was a moment of irreversible knowledge in my viscera. I just could not forget it, and I knew very quickly after that everything I had learned growing up in our society was probably a lie, and all the assumptions I was living by, which I didn't even know a lot of them, I still probably don't know all of them, was fraudulent. So that was the beginning of what I like to think of as the real Brian Wilson, who was going to be recovering from conditioning. The heavy conditioning of being an obedient servant of the nation state. I was, when I had been drafted, I was in a combined law school criminology master's program, and I was planning to be probably a criminal lawyer, and I knew that somehow my life was going to be radically changed because I just didn't think I could believe in anything I was taught. So that began a journey that's still happening. This book describes the journey. It's been through many chapters, this journey, from the small town kid that was so kind of happy and naive and in bliss, to these changes that occurred because I was in the military in Vietnam, and then lots of changes that kept happening as obstacles were put in my path. Just, I didn't know kind of how my life was going to unfold. So I did pass the bar and became a lawyer. And another experience in the courtroom jolted me once again. I could not stand up for the judge when the judge came into the courtroom, when the bailiff said, "Everybody rise." I was not even aware that I was going to have this problem before I heard his voice say, "Everybody rise." But my body didn't want to get up. It was a very visceral reaction to authority. I didn't even think about it initially. It was just my body that didn't want to rise. It didn't want to use the energy to stand up, and I didn't. And I wasn't planning on it. I wasn't intending. I didn't know the judge. I didn't know anything, really. And the judge called me up and said very politely, "Son, you know, the protocol is you'll stand up when the judge comes in." I said, "Yes, Your Honor," and fully intending to comply, but it happened two more times in a week. And actually, I can't say that I was even proud of it. I was really kind of ashamed that I could not adapt to the rules of my profession. And so I didn't tell anybody about it. I just left the courtroom and said, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do this. And I was married at the time to a lawyer, and I never told her why I changed my mind about being a lawyer. Because I was embarrassed, quite frankly. I was ashamed initially. But I knew the response of my body, which I call body wisdom, was so strong, I could not overwhelm my head saying, just do it, just obey, just comply so you can do you can be your lawyer that you want to be. So that was another experience that taught me that I better listen to my body, because my body was telling me a truth, that my head was still pretty conditioned into compliance and obedience. And after all, we live in the era of enlightenment and reason and rationality, but what happened to the wisdom connected to our body and the earth? And so I also began being really interested in resuming my experiences in nature. As a boy, I'd been really I'd fished and swam, and I was in a very rural area, and I loved growing up in with all the greenery and the bushes and the trees. And I had read Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and often wondered whether that silent spring was happening in my village back in upstate New York. And in fact, I learned later that it was. So I started examining the whole model of Western civilization, the whole model of industrial civilization, and where was its origins, and how did it affect humanity, how did it affect cultures? And of course, it's built on many levels of exploitation and plunder, meaning somebody was in the way of the exploitation, and they were treated as if they were nothing. And I started having experiences in my travels. I went in the 70s. I went to many prisons all over the United States because I was working as a lawyer, but not in the courtroom. And at one time, I was working with a national moratorium on prison construction, funded by the Unitarian Universal Service Committee, that was later directed by Michael Kroll, who's sitting in the room here from Oakland. But I also began to realize that I had to go deeper into the whole social economic base upon which our values are formed. That the criminal injustice system itself is really basically a smokescreen for enabling the basic society to stay intact and have this group of people they can identify as the problems in our society. When I had been, had this experience of witnessing village after village after village of being destroyed by bombs, and they were not considered crimes by my country. They were considered acts for which the pilots were rewarded. Pretty amazing, really. And so this is kind of the history of Western civilization. This is the way it's unfolded. And so I wanted to know more about obedience and how easy it is for whole groups of people to comply with a society that is destroying the planet, even building weapon systems to protect our way of life, which itself is killing us. It's very astounding that we can do this, that I could do it. So I started going to Central America, studying Reagan's policies in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala. And I was seeing more and more of this devastation, this killing of people, this maiming of people as if they didn't count. And again, I was feeling incredible connection to these people, like they are the same as me. What on earth are we doing? How can we do this? And so that... And of course, I was doing what others were doing. I was petitioning Congress in those days to uphold international law and not be killing innocent people. And of course, they just kept funding it and using different language to justify it. Always got great, noble-sounding rhetoric to justify anything. And that's what those experiences led me to the tracks, because Concord was the source of the weapons going to Central America. And we couldn't count on Congress to change the law or stop funding, So we thought, okay, we'll just go and block the trains, knowing that the trains are likely to continue to go, but not without having to arrest people saying, you can't move these munitions in my name. And so that's what led me to the tracks with other people in the summer of 1987. It didn't seem like a very complicated process to me in terms of my own thinking and feeling and expression. And it was not certainly dangerous because the trains can have a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit. There's a definite protocol about how to remove protesters from the tracks before they move the train. I had been an installation security officer in the military. I knew that commanders of bases do not take chances with munitions when they're moving them. There was 350 armed Marines at Concord at the time. So I was not worried about a dangerous situation. I was very aware that I was likely to go to jail. And so when I woke up in the hospital 4 days after I was struck, I have no memory of it to this day, I couldn't believe what people were telling me. I was run over by the train. The train can't veer to the left or the right. The munitions trucks that parallel on a road to the tracks, the truck driver sometimes tried to move around the protesters, but a train can't do that. So I actually chose what I thought was the safer route to block munitions, which was on the tracks rather than on the road. And so it was very hard to believe. But we did find out that the train crew that day was ordered not to stop the train, and they were accelerating to 17 miles an hour at the time of impact, that there was a belief, or at least they stated this, that I and the two others who were blocking the trains that day were going to hijack the train. This was the first question I was asked by an interrogator when I was in the hospital. When did you plan to block? When did you plan to board the train, i.e. hijack? I was shocked. 2 or 3 days later, however, the FBI agent Jack Ryan in Peoria, Illinois, was fired for refusing, and this was in the newspaper, for refusing to investigate Duncan Murphy and I, who were two of the three men on the tracks, as domestic terrorist suspects. So I started getting the picture. This was an intentional murder. The Navy acknowledged they knew about my fast the year before on the steps of the Capitol that went on for 47 days on water only in protest to Reagan's policies, and they acknowledged that Wilson and Murphy, the other vet on the tracks who was a domestic terror suspect, had also been with me on the fast in 86, that they were serious protesters and had to be taken seriously. So when we told the base we were going to do this in a letter, they knew we weren't blowing smoke. And we knew there was a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit. So at any rate, all this is laid out in the book, and there's 112 photographs in here, about 30 of which are from the tracks that day. There were 5 photographers and a videographer. So I don't know if anybody else has ever been run over by a train head-on with it so well documented. Pretty amazing, really. Now, some of the themes that run through my book are dignity trumps longevity. Longevity is nothing without the dignity. I learned this from many people around the world, especially those people who are struggling against at great odds to assure them some justice in their cultures, most of them being killed in that process. Another one is that we have been living in an era of entitlement enabled by plunder without thinking about it, really. And we're entering an era of consequences, which provides us an opportunity. In other words, the chickens are coming home to roost after all these 500 years of exploitation. And it provides an opportunity to learn about humility, which opens us up to our empathy, which everybody has because it's part of our genetic code. We survived as hominids and then modern man, women, with cooperation trumping competition and empathy trumping selfishness. Now, in Western societies, we've learned to be individualistic rather than community-oriented. We've learned to be competitive rather than cooperative. And we've learned acquisition versus inquisition. You acquire things, that's a very important value, versus a curiosity that questions things. And another theme is horizontal trumps vertical. We've been living in vertical structures essentially for 6,000 years, 6 or 8,000 years. We don't even think about it. Most of us live in what we've called a democratic society, which is as vertical as dictatorial societies and monarchical societies. And we learn to be obedient in order to have our material acquisition and comfort. But it's all at the expense of other people on the planet. And so we haven't been taught to see the consequences. We haven't been taught to feel the consequences. If you felt the consequences, most people would have to make shifts in their life because they would understand the connections between what I'm doing right now and how it's affecting somebody else. This is kind of a radical shift in Western thinking, but we are about to be corrected. There is massive corrections in the works, whether we want to be part of the correction or not. We've been living so at odds with fundamental principles of ecology, physics, every principle, you know, economics, community, integrity, certainly ecology, and quantum physics tells us everything's connected also. Everything's connected everywhere at every moment. So we've been living at odds with our fundamental nature. That's why there's so much sickness and pathology in these class-oriented, stratified cultures that dominate the West. And we hear politicians talking about protecting the middle class. Well, protecting the middle class assumes that we ignore the lower class and that that's okay to have these classes and that we want to join, we in the middle class want to join some of the semblance of the upper class. Really, class divisions perpetuates among the most toxic psychic feelings that destroy both individual and social health, because there's always somebody above you, somebody better than you, somebody worse than you, and it's not healthy. And so I would submit that we don't really want to be promoting any kind of a class. So in order for this all to happen, of course, there has to be radical shifts in the way we think and feel. And we know, I think we know, if we don't kind of wake up to the fact that we've been living in this illusion, this fantasy of consumption, that it's not going to last. And we're all kind of wondering how this is going to play out. And so my cycling was just a little gesture. It doesn't even mean that much. It's just a little gesture of demonstrating that I want to reduce my consumption of carbon and my pollution of the carbon in the air. And I enjoy cycling, so it's really, for me, a win-win thing. I refuse to fly. I've refused to fly for 11 years. Means I haven't done a lot of trips that I would like to have taken, but I've just said that's it. I have flown a lot. I've flown all over the world. I've had tremendous experiences because my flying enabled me to go to other cultures. But I got to the point when I was 60. I said, you know, I've looked at my carbon footprint, and one flight a year ruins all the other things I'm doing to save my energy. One flight a year. That was a radical change for me. I stopped flying. People would say, will you come and speak here in South Carolina or here in Mexico? I said, nope, I'm not flying. If I can't cycle there in a few days or if I can't take the train in 3 or 4 days, I just can't do it. So I don't know. We're wired socially. That's another theme in my book. We're literally wired socially. We cannot live without cooperation. Not the way we've been particularly conditioned, but the way we've been conditioned, I submit, the way I was conditioned, I submit, will destroy us. And it was going to destroy me. if I didn't get a handle on it. And it's still a process. I'm still processing from that moment 42 years ago in that village in Vietnam. I'm still unfolding from that. And I believe that human beings have the capacity for radical shifts in behavior and consciousness, especially when survival demands it. And our survival demands radical shifts in the way we think and live. Radical shifts. It's like an epistemological break from our past, a whole different way of thinking, relating to how we're feeling about our interconnections. That is really a revolution, or an evolution, if you want, an evolutionary leap. In my book, I try to stress that, without hammering it, because I'm still working on it myself, that really it's up to us whether we want to survive. And if we want to continue business as usual, all we have to do is keep doing what we're doing. And when we complain about mountaintop removal, 500 mountaintops in West Virginia to get coal, and deep water drilling, and tar sands removal, and fracking for natural gas in 36 states, which winds up coming out in tap water and flames, and nuclear power, which Obama wants to continue even after Fukushima with a nuclear renaissance. All of these efforts to seek more energy is to satisfy our demands. Not just our demands now, but in China and India, we're an energy force, a political force, living our life with all this speed and volume as if the Earth is infinite. And so, as much as, of course, the extraction is creating trillions of dollars for the cabal, which owns the political process, making petitioning and voting virtually either worthless or even worse than that, legitimizes the system. And we want to recover our humanity, or I do. I want to recover my sense of being on the planet with nature, with butterflies and bees and birds and people. And it isn't going to happen if we keep putting the carbon molecules in the air and we keep demanding this incredible energy consumption. So these energy companies know we want the energy. And so they will go and continue to extract it until there's none left. And we have a choice to say, you know, this is suicide. Continuing to do this is not in our best interest. But it's a shift. It's a break from an addiction to a comfort which has been built on 500 years of colonialism, 20% of the Eurocentric world plundered, 80% of the rest. So all this material stuff we have has been stolen. We stole the land from the indigenous. We're built on dispossession. I consider that is the most severe psychic scar we have as a culture. We have to address the fact that we stole the land and killed the people who are here, and hundreds of nations that were living here. Do we think we can get away with this forever? I mean, we did it with impunity. And then we stole human beings from Africa to build our original agricultural base and the early industrial base and killed millions. Do we really think we can get away with this? Well, so far, with impunity. And then in the 20th century, we went all over the world stealing resources at gunpoint. Marines landing everywhere, always justified by noble-sounding rhetoric. Protect our freedom. Chomsky calls it the fifth freedom. You know about Roosevelt's four freedoms. The freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, freedom from fear. We don't take those very seriously, but we do take this seriously. The freedom to plunder, exploit, rob, and rape. And when that freedom is interfered with, we send in the Marines. And we call it saving democracy and our way of life and prosperity. So I think it's kind of a moment in which we have to reconcile the fact that we've been living off lie, exploitation, justified by lies, with tremendous suffering imposed on the rest of the planet itself, and human beings on the planet. And it's all been done with impunity. So we think we are an exceptional society with all this development. Everybody has an iPod and cell phones. And, you know, the resources that go into making those little chips for these cell phones and computers and iPods, a lot of it's coming from the Congo, where these precious metals are found. And 10 million Congolese have been murdered in 15 years because they're in the way of the companies that are extracting the minerals to give us the products that we all think we need to have. And so, an era of consequences. Sooner or later, this impunity we've enjoyed will come home to roost. And we're kind of at that point in human history. The correction is going to happen. And I think one of our tasks is to prepare ourselves emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually for collapse. And know that it's, in effect, a blessing, even though it will be horrible. It will seem horrible. It will be very painful. Many of us will not continue to live. But it's happening. It's going to happen. We're running out of all resources, including copper. Even the coal and natural gas have much shorter life reserves than we have been told. We know that we're running out of cheap oil. And so... the most radical thing we can do is downsize our lives and stop consuming, which means cooperation with others. In other words, community replaces money. Simplicity replaces complexity. Our dependence on centralized systems, all of which require oil and electricity. And I will say, in closing, that I hung around an Amish blacksmith when I was a kid. I lived near 11 Amish communities. And this Amish blacksmith used to ask me a question, which was a ha-ha-ha question in the 50s. What are you moderns going to do when the electrons stop? And I laughed. Yeah, right. Now I think of it as prophetic. What will we do when the electrons stop? I'll stop there.